content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by J. Suggs Insurance. Please contact J. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 29, 2025. Time, as usual, on the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border, and the photo on the cover, which might have been in black and white, is actually in red and white. Time itself, T-I-M-E, in large block capital lettering, is in black, superimposed upon this red and black background. The caption reads, "Enough. The Killing of Charlie Kirk and the Epidemic of American Political Violence" by Eric Cortaleza. There's a mob scene here, a crowd, a very large crowd from back to front are a tent. And the tent is tinted in red with black. It says, "American Comeback Tour, Prove Me Wrong, Prove Me Wrong." There's an individual seated on a high stool within the tent. And there are, oh goodness, layers of people, dozens in this crowd facing that person in the tent. Beginning with nine questions. This is usually the end page of the magazine, and I'm starting with it today. Let's see if there really are nine. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yep. This is written by Belinda Luscom. It's David Lauren, L-A-U-R-E-N. The fashion executive talks about AI, tariffs, and working for his father for 25 years. There's an individual photograph. At the bottom of the page is an undoubtedly dapper-looking gentleman with longish, graying hair. He's grinning just surreptitiously at the camera. He's wearing a dark-colored, it's in a black and white, so I don't know the coloration, a dark-colored double-breasted suit, white shirt, dark-colored tie with some kind of pattern, widespread pattern on it, and a niftily folded white handkerchief in the suit pocket. Ralph Lauren has a wide range of businesses. Is there any new area you'd like to move into? That's question one. Answer. This entire page is a question-answer format. Answer. We've just started a hospitality business. Our coffee and our restaurants are probably as popular as our polo shirts and sunglasses. I think there's an opportunity to allow people to live in the Ralph Lauren ads. We'd love to open hotels. Question, you're the chief innovation officer and chief branding officer at Ralph Lauren. What does that actually mean you do? Answer, every time we design products, there are stories that inspire the products. My job is to help bring those stories to life, to inspire our customers to want to be engaged in our world. Sometimes it's creating events, sometimes immersive experiences online, sometimes it's a fashion show in China. Question, a lot of people do not want to work for their parents. What's it like? Answer, to work for my dad. My dad is my best friend. He's my mentor and inspiration. I'm so lucky to have somebody who cares about what I do and wants to educate me. The good thing when he loves what I do is that your dad, your mentor, and your boss love something. but there's nothing more painful than when your dad, your mentor, your boss, does not like your idea, and I live with that a lot as well. Question, what's the purpose of your new AI tool? Ask Ralph. Answer, we want to give people the confidence to live their better lives. This is a tool to create a personal connection with a customer because you are taking clothes that mean nothing and finding a way to make them personal. It's like having Ralph Lauren in your back pocket 24/7, as if you could pick up the phone and ask Ralph Lauren what to wear. Question, do you have a favorite Ralph Lauren era? Answer, I've been with my dad as we drove across the West. I watched him discover all these great Navajo blankets and the great Western saddles and Western art. So to see it come onto the runway and still impact designers today is amazing. A designer in Paris just put a horse on the runway. That's very Ralph Lauren. Question, a lot of the label's growth this quarter came from Asia and Europe. Are you worried about tariffs? Answer, we are constantly monitoring the ecosystem and the business dynamics in the world. Our job is to navigate as best we can, and so far I think we're doing very well. Answer, another question. You have a family with a big legacy. You've married into a family with a big legacy. How do you make sure your three children do not feel too much privilege and also do not disappear under the weight of being a Bush and a Lauren? Answer, we both believe we came from lives that were privileged but full of values. It is wonderful to have access, and it's wonderful to feel like you have a great name, but that comes with responsibility and a legacy of families that believe in work. My father still comes into the office all the time. Lauren's grandfather, President George H.W. Bush, and her uncle, President George W. Bush, really believe in making the world better. Question, Ralph Lauren as a company is known for being progressive, and the Bush family is known for being conservative. Is there tension in the in-law political leanings? Answer, not at all. We believe in what we believe in, and I think everybody has done a great job making the world better. Last question, do the kids wear all Ralph Lauren? Answer, there's never been any pressure from my father. Whatever we love, we love. My father has shopped at Walmart and Kmart and wears it very publicly. It's more about the fact that we do love what he makes. My kids right now are into soccer jerseys and the New York Yankees, and thank God we have a partnership with the Yankees, so it is working for us. Now to the brief. This nearly replicates the cover photo, but not quite. American Crisis by Eric Cortaleza, the killing of Charlie Kirk, and the political violence that haunts the nation. Again, there's a huge crowd in the foreground of this full-page photo. Apparently, security guards are monitoring it because they're facing the crowd. Walking then along a narrow pathway in the grass, with fencing on either side, is a person. He looks tallish to me, but I don't have too much with which to compare it. A white shirt that says freedom, black pants, white shoes. He's carrying a red cap that says Make America Great Again. He has brown hair, pretty closely cropped, but tousled on top. I think he has brown eyes, and he's smiling. And in the background, there is a building, and behind that, there is a blue sky. The photograph is by Tess Crowley. The person in the photograph, the main focus person, is not identified. Charlie Kirk was doing what he so often did, working a college crowd, prodding and provoking students in debate. The 31-year-old founder of Turning Point USA was at Utah Valley University near Salt Lake City, September 10, surrounded by thousands of students gathered in an outdoor courtyard. It was the first stop of Kirk's fall campus tour, and he was seated beneath a tent emblazoned with the words, "The American Comeback." Kirk became a star in these settings. Since founding his right-wing advocacy organization at 18, he proved peerless at channeling youthful discontent into political energy, shaping a movement with national reach. As Kirk fielded questions from the audience, a shot rang out, striking him in the neck. Panicked students scattered. Kirk was rushed to the hospital. Grisly footage of the shooting rocketed across social media. Inside the West Wing, staff sat in shocked silence, scrolling their screens to see the latest updates. At 4:40 p.m., Donald Trump announced Kirk's death on Truth Social. No one, the president wrote, understood or had the heart of the youth in the United States of America better than Charlie. He leaves behind a wife and two children. In recent years, the prospect of a political assassination like this, carried out before a stunned crowd in broad daylight, has hung over a nation riven by factional fury. Elected officials whispered about it in green rooms and on campaign buses. When the moment arrived, it unfolded with chilling precision. A campus stage, a microphone, a single gunshot. Where it will lead now is an ominous question with no obvious answers. Kirk was one of the most powerful and incendiary figures on the American right, the tireless tribune of Trump's young army. To admirers, he was a defender of free expression in hostile territory. To critics, a provocateur who thrived on the rancor of the age. The size and fervor of his audiences spoke to his place in the conservative firmament. The most influential voice of my generation, as Trump advisor and family friend Alex Brusewitz puts it. America's a nation shaped by political violence and steeped in its aftershocks. The 1960s were scarred by political assassinations from Kennedy to King. But in recent years, acts of brazen violence have been the grim drumbeat of a debased national politics. In 2021, the year Trump supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol, there were more than 9,600 recorded threats against members of Congress, according to the Capitol Police. The following year saw a hammer-wielding assailant attack Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, in their San Francisco home, and the attempted stabbing of New York gubernatorial candidate Lee Zeldin at a campaign rally. In 2024, Trump himself faced two attempts on his life, including the history-bending afternoon in Butler, Pennsylvania, when he turned his head at the instant an assassin fired, the bullet grazing his ear instead of piercing his skull. This year, the threat grew more insistent. The residence of Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, a Democrat, was set on fire by an arsonist. A gunman shot two Democratic Minnesota legislators and their spouses. Two Israeli embassy staffers were shot and killed outside the Capitol Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C. A man shouting "Free Palestine" tossed Molotov cocktails at a pro-Israeli demonstration in Boulder, Colorado. And a gunman who allegedly held anti-vaccine views opened fire at CDC headquarters in Atlanta. I think the evidence is clear that we're at a dangerous point of potential escalation, says Shannon Hiller, executive director of Princeton University's Bridging Divides Initiative. which tracks political violence in the U.S. She argues a range of forces, the widespread use of dehumanizing rhetoric, the availability of firearms, the spread of disinformation, vanishing trust in institutions, have converged to create an intractable problem. It's the confluence of all these things that we're living in, she says, and it's why it's so hard to put a finger on a single solution to get us out of it. Kirk's path to national prominence was unlike that of other MAGA icons. Born in a Chicago suburb, he gravitated toward conservative politics in a predominantly liberal enclave. At 17, he volunteered for a Republican U.S. Senate campaign. He drew notice by writing an essay for the right-wing site Breitbart News, alleging his school textbooks were freighted with liberal bias. Kirk's zeal caught the attention of Bill Montgomery, a businessman and Tea Party activist, who urged him to forego college and dedicate himself fully to political organizing. With Montgomery's seed money, Kirk founded Turning Point USA. He had a knack for finding wealthy patrons drawn to his entrepreneurial panache. GOP megadonor Foster Frias was one of them, writing a check for $10,000 to help get the fledgling organization off the ground. Republican strategist Michael Biondo was among many to observe how confident Kirk was from the jump. He always loved the challenge of changing the hearts and minds of the youth. He saw them as the future, the turning point to move the needle of conservative policies and principles, Biondo says. He took the battle right to the campuses with both his words and his debating style. His impact in this realm cannot be overstated. What began as an effort to rally college students against liberal orthodoxy morphed into something bigger. Kirk made headlines with his professor watch list, which targeted academics accused of suppressing conservative speech or promoting left-wing propaganda. He reveled in provocations that delighted the right and incensed the left. Kirk argued some gun violence deaths were a reasonable price to pay for preserving the Second Amendment, called for a patriot to bail out Paul Pelosi's attacker, helped to spread baseless rumors that Haitian migrants in Ohio were eating people's pets, and once called the Civil Rights Act a huge mistake. The list of people he offended, often intentionally, was as long as his roster of supporters. Over time, Turning Point grew into a well-funded, multi-pronged organization, a media outlet, a voter turnout machine, a hub for student chapters on thousands of high school and college campuses. They're all symbiotic, Kirk told me a few weeks ago. They all feed one another. Kirk was not initially a Trump backer. During the 2016 Republican presidential primary, he supported Scott Walker and Ted Cruz before endorsing Trump. During the thick of the campaign, an associate arranged a meeting with Donald Trump Jr., who hired Kirk on the spot. For the rest of the campaign, he worked as Trump Jr.'s assistant, a role that vaulted him deeper into Trump world and secured his place within its inner orbit. After Trump's victory in 2016, Kirk returned his focus to Turning Point and quickly fashioned himself into one of the president's most zealous defenders. He shed the vestiges of Reaganite libertarianism and embraced the national populist framework that undergirded Trump's political project, restricting immigration, imposing tariffs, rejecting foreign entanglements. It is not a metamorphosis, he once told me. It's a journey. In 2019, Kirk launched Turning Point Action, a political group dedicated to defeating Democrats and boosting Trump-aligned Republicans. The COVID-19 pandemic propelled him to a new level of prominence. Kirk began recording multiple podcasts a day, railing against mask mandates and school closures. He became a fixture on Fox News, where his tirades caught Trump's attention. One evening, Kirk delivered a phrase that crystallized conservative anger: the cure cannot be worse than the disease. Trump heard it, liked it, began repeating it himself. In the years that followed, Kirk became one of Trump's most unshakable allies. He amplified Trump's false claims that the 2020 election had been stolen and pressed the case for J.D. Vance as Trump's running mate. By 2024, Turning Point was running the voter mobilization drive in Arizona that the campaign relied upon, an effort that helped return the pivotal swing state to Trump's column. By then, Kirk had amassed millions of followers across social media, and the Charlie Kirk Show became one of the most popular political podcasts in the country. He was a one-man persuasion campaign on Trump's behalf, helping the Republican notch a surprisingly strong performance with young voters last November. After Trump's return to the White House was assured, Kirk decamped to a donor's condo in West Palm Beach to help manage the transition, vetting prospective appointees for loyalty. When Trump took the oath of office, Kirk stood only steps away. This summer, I joined Kirk in Phoenix, where we spent hours talking as he showed me around Turning Point's headquarters, a sprawling six-building complex, each devoted to another wing of the labyrinthine organization he had conjured from scratch. When I walked in, he was dressed in a T-shirt and sweatpants, padding around in his socks and anxiously checking the score of the Chicago Cubs game. He and his aides were deep in planning a fall speaking tour, anticipating ever larger crowds. Kirk mused about writing a book on the core tenets of MAGA, but his focus, as ever, was on building a movement that could endure for years to come. He was thinking about who might carry Trump's torch forward. If J.D. wants to run, he has my full support, Kirk told me. I will do everything in my power to make him president. Row one, day one. For Kirk's friends and allies, the assassination is shattering, both for the personal loss and for what they fear it portends. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be the last, which is why it's so scary, says Representative Ana Paulina Luna of Florida, the first Turning Point alumna elected to Congress. Her words carried the tremor of recognition in American life. Acts of political violence have rarely been isolated. The murder of Martin Luther King Jr. fueled riots across the country. The shooting of Gabby Giffords deepened the atmosphere of paranoia and mistrust. The January 6 attack, with its scenes of armed men roaming the Capitol, enraged the left and illustrated the extreme grievances gripping the right. Kirk's sudden public death risks joining that chain. His killing could become not just a tragedy, but a catalyst, an event that radicalizes ever more Americans, less an aberration than a feature of our increasingly perilous national politics. Again, that was the brief, American Crisis by Eric Cortellesa. The brief business, this is one page, a new class of super companies by Charlotte Q-H-U. In the past year, tariffs, AI, and changing consumer sentiments have made once dominant companies reshuffle their growth strategies. New giants emerged amid this shift. NVIDIA, which this summer became the first public company to hit $4 trillion in market value, tops Time and Statista's new statistical ranking of the world's best companies of 2025. The list measures employee satisfaction, revenue growth, sustainability, transparency. NVIDIA rose through the ranks on a wave of growing AI demand and a well-performing gaming division. Many companies ranked high on the list have benefited from that enthusiasm for AI. Microsoft, ranked second on this list and right behind NVIDIA in market value, also saw surges in revenue throughout 2024 driven by AI and cloud computing. Apple, which topped the world's best companies list in 2024, is notably absent this year because of a decline in revenue from 2022 to 2024, which many Wall Street analysts have postulated could be due to the company's falling behind on AI. But tides may be turning as the behemoth figures out its footing in the new tech landscape. CEO Tim Cook said on a third quarter earnings call that the company is significantly growing investments in AI, embedding it across devices and platforms. In July, after the study period for this list, Apple reported 10% year-over-year revenue growth, the biggest bump since 2021. Nike, number 14, is the highest-ranked apparel, footwear, and sporting goods company, surpassing luxury giant LVMH, number 21, and athleisure queen Lululemon, number 36. The company faced a few rocky years because of competition from breakout brands like On and Hoka, and last year brought in a new CEO, Elliot Hill, to invest heavily in big sport moments and key product launches to win back our brand voice, Hill said in an earnings call in June. In summer, game day looks for tennis champions Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner bumped sales. Drug maker Novo Nordisk, number 15, is also innovating to stay ahead. Building on the popularity of its game-changing diabetes and weight loss drugs, Ozempic and Wegovy, the company's now launching an oral semaglutide to retain its lead against rivals like Eli Lilly. When we think about the obesity market in the U.S., everyone knows we're in a competitive environment, David Moore, EVP of U.S. Operations at Novo Nordisk, two words, said in an earnings call in August. We are still growing. The market is growing. Okay, Time has compiled this top 20 world's best companies list for 2025. I'll read them in order from 1, the top, to 20, and I'll indicate the country where the headquarters exist. I will not read all of the other data. 1, NVIDIA, U.S. 2, Microsoft, U.S. J.P. Morgan Chase, U.S. Alphabet, U.S. Amazon, U.S. Meta, U.S. Volkswagen Group, Germany. BBVA, Spain. Airbus, Netherlands. Cigna, U.S. DBS Bank, Singapore. Allianz, Germany. Ford, U.S. Nike, U.S. Novo Nordisk, Denmark. Booking Holdings, U.S. MasterCard, U.S. Deutsche Telekom, Germany. Schneider Electric, France. General Motors, U.S. Turning the page, and I have here, goodness, 1 3/4 page photo. It is a photo. The background is bright green, and there is a person reaching in the foreground. This person is on his tiptoes. His arms are outspread. The right hand holds a tennis racket, in front of which is a yellow tennis ball. The person is wearing pink and purple. And the shirt, which is bright pink, does have what I think is the Nike signature logo. It's like a rounded check mark. The pants the man is wearing are purple, as are the shoes, but he's wearing black socks. He has a closely shaved head of black hair and black facial hair. And I'll read the caption. It's Carlos Alcaraz, A-L-C-A-R-A-Z, reaches for a Yannick Sinner shot at the U.S. Open Finals, September 7, in New York City. The photograph is by Javier Rojas, Zuma Press Wire, Reuters. And there's one column of text here, along with this rather large photo, 1 3/4 pages. Sean Gregory writes, under the sports heading, in a great rivalry, a great victory. In 2025, for the first time in modern tennis history, the same two men met in three major tennis tournament finals in the same year. Carlos Alcaraz, 22 of Spain, won his first duel with Italy's Yannick Sinner, 24, at the French Open in Paris. That comeback, a five-set, five-hour-plus thriller, still stands as the year's outstanding sports moment. Sinner got Alcaraz back with a clinical four-set victory at Wimbledon. But on September 7, under the watchful eye of President Donald Trump and a host of other celebrity attendees, Alcaraz outlasted Sinner 6-2, 3-6, 6-1, 6-4, in an inspiring effort that put all his brilliance on display. He reclaimed the world number one ranking and the U.S. Open win, the second of Alcaraz's career, already gives him 6 Grand Slam championships. "I am seeing you more than my family," Alcaraz told Sinner after the match. Tennis fans are a spoiled bunch. Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer retired. Alcaraz and Sinner quickly emerged. They split the 2025 majors with a pair of victories apiece. Sinner, who won the Australian Open, became one of 4 men's players ever to have reached the finals of all 4 major tournaments in the same season. With Rod Laver or Laver, Federer, and Novak Djokovic, the others. He had an awesome year. Last and best word, though, goes to Alcaraz. Under the world heading, rebooting South Korea, President Lee Jae-myung on his plan to kickstart his nation's economy and court Donald Trump, by Charlie Campbell Sowell. With reporting by Stephen Kim Sowell. I may abridge this, it's rather lengthy. It was not how Lee Jae-myung envisioned his first day on the job. And his name is spelled L-E-E space J-A-E hyphen M-Y-U-N-G. Following his election as South Korea's president, June 3, Lee's staff arrived at their new offices in central Seoul the next morning to find rooms strewn with trash and desks equipped with monitors but bereft of computers, which had all been piled in a corner. It was a struggle to get doors unlocked and find even basic stationery. It was a very busy and chaotic period, Lee, 61, tells Time in his only Western media interview since taking office. I thought we had done much preparation in advance, but it was not sufficient. Behind the chaos was his disgraced predecessor, Yoon Suk-yeol, whose December declaration of martial law plunged the East Asian nation of 50 million into 6 months of political paralysis that concluded with Yoon's impeachment and, after a snap poll, Lee's election. Just over 100 days on, the new leader has moved with such speed that the chaos he encountered on his first day seems like a distant memory. In Seoul, one of the world's most densely populated cities, he has imposed a 600 million won, $430,000 cap on mortgage loans for property purchases to quell an overheated housing market. A new labor law, meanwhile, has reduced legal liabilities for striking workers, and some $10 billion of cash vouchers, ranging from $110 to $330, have been distributed to every citizen, depending on income, to boost local business. One of my biggest accomplishments is South Korea's domestic political situation has been stabilized, he says. For all the action at home, perhaps his greatest challenge was external. The turbulence caused by Yoon's martial law declaration meant South Korea languished half a year behind other nations in negotiating a new trade deal with the Trump administration. Seoul and Washington have had a free trade agreement since 2012, and last year South Korea sent cars worth $34.74 billion to the U.S., accounting for about half of the Asian nation's auto exports, a figure that plummeted when the Trump administration imposed levies of 25%. July 31, Lee negotiated a reduction of 15% in exchange for pledges to invest $350 billion in the U.S. and other concessions. It was a critical milestone, and one that is central to Lee's plan to re-energize a moribund economy, the home of world-leading firms such as Samsung, Hyundai, and LG spent decades at technology's vanguard, but fortunes have wilted in recent years because of a stifling regulatory environment, demographic pressures, and fierce competition from China. After years of steady decline, South Korea's GDP grew by only 2% in 2024, less than half the Asia-Pacific average. Lee, who has hiked spending on science and technology by almost 20%, wants to turn things around by creating a super innovation economy. His government, he says, will invest $71.5 billion over the next 5 years to transform South Korea into one of the top three AI nations worldwide. And in July, Tesla inked a $16.5 billion deal to produce AI chips at Samsung's new semiconductor foundry in Texas. Geopolitically, Lee wants to position South Korea as a bridge between East and West. Leaders of Lee's Progressive Democratic Party have traditionally been closer to China, hostile toward former colonizer Japan, and kept the U.S. at arm's length. Lee, however, pointedly made Tokyo his first foreign visit en route to Washington and pledged to work as partners with Japan's prime minister in the neighbor's first joint statement in 17 years. Lee's actions are meant to reboot South Korea. The West may think of his nation in terms of space-age technology and zeitgeist-defining cultural phenomena like K-pop demon hunters, though in truth South Korea battles the lowest birth rate, top suicide rate, and highest youth unemployment of any developed nation. Lee is clear-eyed about the stakes. South Korea is in a very serious crisis, he says. To address these issues, we need to bring our economy back on track for growth and increase opportunities for our people. The previous article was abridged, and here's another article under the heading World: Crisis in the Shadows. Millions displaced, famine spreading, yet Sudan's tragedy unfolds far from the world's gaze. By Charlie Campbell. Invisible anguish is especially wretched. That's been Sudan's lot. during 2 years of brutal civil war, slaughter that's claimed some 150,000 lives and forced almost a quarter of its population of 50 million to flee their homes. Yet this forgotten war has received scant attention from an international community preoccupied with carnage in Ukraine and Gaza and rising tensions in East Asia. That Sudan's plight remains largely hidden is what struck Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Moise Saman when he spent almost 2 weeks in Darfur and Sudanese refugee camps in neighboring Chad in July and August. What makes this conflict unique is the fact that it's in the shadows, says Saman. This huge civil war is having such deep humanitarian consequences, but has not been given the attention it deserves. Sadly, it is a conflict without any glimmer of resolution, for while historic animosities fuel the fighting, Sudan is yet another proxy conflict between the Middle East's squabbling theocracies, with Qatar and Iran major backers of the Sudanese government, and the UAE bankrolling the RSF, according to UN sanctions monitors. Abu Dhabi steadfastly denies stoking the bloodshed. The grim irony of Sudan's predicament is that Africa's third largest country boasts significant mineral reserves, including huge quantities of gold, as well as vast swaths of arable land. Yet foreign powers feuding over these precious resources have destroyed countless lives, as well as any hope of a prosperous future. Adds Saman, these are people that just want to survive until tomorrow. Saman, the photographer, has contributed several photographs to this article. I did abridge the text, and the title of the article, again, is Crisis in the Shadows, and all of his photographs that are published here in Time are shadowy. They just are. They're shadowy. They're all in black and white. And I'll describe just a couple for you. But one of them shows what would probably have been a classroom. It's very dark. The walls are not only dingy, but they're marked all over with, I don't know, paint or blood or something. The war, here's a caption, the war in its third year has fractured the Darfur region into isolated enclaves controlled by rival forces. Civilians navigate both violence and failing infrastructure to survive. Well, it looks like a blackboard on this one wall. It's a blackboard with white writing that is not not readable by me. I don't know in what language it is written or in what script. There are about six people in this room. The room has more than just the blackboard. There's a woman dressed in a long dress, and she has quite a large headscarf that matches the dress. She's standing on a platform that looks to me like chunks of concrete. And then off to the side, there's something standing on its end, maybe a table and a couple of chairs in the corner. And in the foreground, in front of the woman standing on the platform in front of the blackboard, are a few more people. There's a woman seated on the ground with a small child in her lap, and another individual holding another small child. The children look happy, but it just looks desperate to me. And then in the opposing page, let's see here, families wait inside Al-Junayah Teaching Hospital, one of the few public hospitals still functioning in West Darfur, supported by Médecins Sans Frontières, That would be Doctors Without Borders, I think. Most medical facilities in the region have been destroyed or abandoned, forcing the remaining hospitals to care for overwhelming numbers with limited staff, scarce medicines, and almost no international funding. So there are a couple of little kids here. They look like they're sitting beneath a makeshift tent. Again, the walls in the back are just horribly marked and defaced and just plain dirty. But the two little children look pretty comfy, actually. They're in what would appear to be pajamas and seated on cushions and comforters. And this tent that I described, is it's like something you would throw over a clothesline to make a pretend tent with. And it's in a translucent fabric, so you can see shadowy figures beneath the tent or behind the first layer of fabric. Then above that is an even shadowy figure. This is where the families are gathering in a hospital. It's just very crowded, mostly with women, again, with the long dresses and the long headscarves or head coverings, I should say. There are charts on the wall that may be helping them understand some of the things having to do with the children that they're bringing. It's just a very shadowy, disturbing kind of scenario. Time Off Reviews Television. Brotherly Love and Loathing in a New York City Thriller by Judy Berman. The Black Rabbit is the kind of Manhattan restaurant that invariably gets described as a clubhouse. Nestled in the armpit where the FDR Drive meets the Brooklyn Bridge, the fictional multi-story establishment that gives the Netflix thriller Black Rabbit its title boasts a historic location, a killer menu, a celebrity co-owner, and a fashionable clientele. As its proprietor, the charismatic former rock frontman, Jake Friedkin, executive producer Jude Law, explains to the crowd assembled there for a trunk show of high-end jewelry, "This is a place where the night could go anywhere." Almost immediately it does. A pair of masked thieves burst in, thrusting guns in people's faces and demanding the jewels. After this energetic intro, Black Rabbit takes viewers back in time a month to trace the convoluted origins of a robbery that's still in progress when the show cuts away from it. The trouble begins when Jake's ne'er-do-well older brother Vince, executive producer Jason Bateman, returns to the city after a stint in Reno, Nevada, that ends with him running over a guy who tried to steal the rare coins he was selling. Given how much money and anxiety Vince has cost him, it is tough to understand why hard-working Jake would welcome him back behind the Rabbit's Bar. The foundation of their complicated relationship is the show's animating mystery. When it stays focused on its two leads, and especially when they are playing off each other, Black Rabbit can be riveting. But the choice creators Zach Balin and Kate Sussman make to overload their scripts with plot instead of deepening the story's many secondary characters flattens the brothers' world. Though it was shot on location, this is a New York of dated archetypes that might have carried a feature but cannot sustain 8 episodes. You can see why Bateman and Law would want to throw their weight behind the project. The roles are meaty, native New Yorkers who escaped a chaotic Coney Island household to become stars of the city's Y2K-era rock revival with their band, the Black Rabbits. Jake was the pinup, while drummer Vince was the artist, and the drug-abusing liability, a dynamic that has persisted. Before the Rabbit, Jake was managing a famous multi-hyphenate artist, Wes Sopa DeRisu, now a partner. Vince was the dreamer who saw the potential in a dilapidated space that he would ultimately be too busy drinking, snorting, and gambling to help transform. This dichotomy, the sweaty striver versus the tortured genius, is not novel, but the show complicates it via the sinister smarm baked into many of Law's best performances and the embattled decency palpable beneath Bateman's Cousin It makeover. There's good in Vince, rotten in Jake, and gray area in their symbiotic relationship. One trait the brothers share is they're both terrible with money, which makes Black Rabbit the kind of thriller that derives its pressure from a desperation to raise an impossible amount of cash in an unfeasibly short period. Whether such a plot comes across as a tired trope or the reinvention of a classic depends on execution. In Black Rabbit, it's a little of both. A clubby restaurant makes a novel setting, but the number of new messes the Friedkins create gets repetitive. Our glimpse at their formative moments arrives too late to serve the needs of the story. But the real missed opportunity is the failure to give the dozen-plus characters around the Friedkins much personality or purpose. Children's execs, chefs, and skeevy associates are short on interiority. Black Rabbit is worth watching for its stylish direction, propulsive pace, and most of all, Law and Bateman's brilliantly cast brother act. But technical polish and faithful execution of genre conventions cannot elevate a show beyond competence. In its own terms, Black Rabbit is a workmanlike Jake, not a visionary Vince. And Black Rabbit is now streaming on Netflix. Time has published in this issue their favorite Latino leaders. I'll read a few of those for you. Tom Llamas, L-L-A-M-A-S, reporting the facts by Charlotte Alter. As the first Latino anchor and managing editor of NBC Nightly News, Tom Llamas knows he has one job. "I am a Hispanic reporter, but I am a reporter," he says. "I think my value and the value of NBC News is that you're just going to get the news." Llamas, 46, was born in Miami to Cuban immigrants. Because his parents had fled communism, I think they really realized that things like freedom of the press, voting, being an educated citizen, all those things are incredibly important, he says. He started interning at Telemundo at 15 and has worked at ABC and NBC, covering top news stories like the Lahaina wildfires, the war in Ukraine, the death of Pope Francis, the 2024 presidential election. Llamas, who succeeded Lester Holt in June, takes the anchor chair at a time when more Americans are getting their news from social media than from TV, according to a May YouGov poll. And digital platforms are eclipsing news organizations as trusted sources. Still, he says, in a world of social media chatter and AI-fueled aggregation, the work he and his colleagues do is more important than ever. Karl Anthony Towns, All-Star Athlete by Sean Gregory. Although Karl Anthony Towns grew up in Piscataway, New Jersey, as a fan of the New York Knicks, his Olympic dreams lie elsewhere. At the 2028 Games, Towns hopes to represent the Dominican Republic, the birthplace of his late mother, and a country he's forged close ties to, having first competed for the Dominican national team when he was 15. In 2024, Towns announced he was providing major funding for a youth basketball training facility near the city of Santiago. The arena will also include classroom space. "They gave my mother life," says Towns, 29, of the DR. "It's only right I give them mine." His other priority, of course, is helping New York win its first NBA title in 53 years, while rallying the city's 700,000-strong Dominican population behind him. "I know you want me to find words," he says, "but words cannot describe how bad I want to win a ring." Katia Escarzareta, I hope I pronounced that properly, Echazarreta, perhaps, Echazarreta, Space Advocate by Jeffrey Kluger. In 2022, Katia Echazarreta became the second Mexican and the first Mexican woman to travel to space, launching aboard a Blue Origin rocket. The flight lasted little more than 10 minutes, but back on Earth, Echazarreta, 30, hopes to make her influence felt in a far more enduring way. She's become a fierce champion of space innovation, establishing her own foundation, the Fundación Espacial Katia Echazarreta, which provides free admission to space camp for kids from Mexico and around the world. And she's lobbied to broaden two provisions in the Mexican Constitution so that they cite space as a sector to be prioritized for development and give the legislature the power to pass appropriate laws. The amendments have been approved by the Chamber of Deputies and are pending before the Senate. Also on her resume, a Barbie in her likeness as part of Mattel's Role Models series, a Mexican Vogue cover, and appearances on CBS's Mission Unstoppable. And she has over 400,000 followers on Instagram and TikTok. Having given birth to her first child last year, Echazarreta has a newfound sense of investment. "I believe that as a mother, and particularly as a Latina Hispanic woman," she says, "it's important to continue with these goals and dreams, which are going to prove to be very important for the next generations." We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.